Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Protecting Vulnerable Patients with Post-Exposure Prophylaxis for Rabies and Tetanus, What, How, and When. This Medscape CME Spotlight is an online roundtable discussion among the chairperson and faculty from the disciplines of medicine, nursing, and pharmacy. All are highly respected and widely published thought leaders in the field. The format uses didactic content, including selected slides, synchronized with a video presentation. The program is presented in streaming video over the internet. Copyright by Dime, this activity is certified by Dime and presented by Kumar Alagappan, MD, FACEP, FAAEM, FIFEM, Chairperson, John Marshall, Pharm D, BCPS, and Kathy Morris, RN, DNP, APRNNP, FNPC, FAANP, AEC. Dr. Alagappan is a professor of clinical emergency medicine, Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Bronx, New York, senior associate chairman, emergency medicine, Long Island Jewish Medical Center, New Hyde Park, New York. Dr. Alagappan has made the following disclosures: Speakers Bureau and or honorarium agreements for or from Sanofi Pasteur SA, Tailcrisp Biotherapeutics, and the Center for Science and Education. Dr. Alagappan will not discuss off-label, investigational, or experimental uses of drugs. Dr. Marshall is a clinical pharmacy coordinator, Division of Critical Care, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Marshall has nothing to disclose. Ms. Morris is an assistant professor, University of Nebraska College of Nursing, Omaha, Nebraska, emergency nurse practitioner, Community Medical Center, Falls City, Nebraska. Kathy Morris has nothing to disclose. The goal of this activity is to assist participants in diagnosing, administering therapy to, and monitoring patients who require hyperimmune globulin therapy. Vaccines are the most successful biomedical innovation in human history and have prevented incalculable suffering and death. Despite their effectiveness, vaccines cannot meet every need for immunity. Potentially life-threatening gaps occur when people cannot or do not get vaccinations, do not have an adequate response to vaccines, or require protection more rapidly than can be achieved through active immunity. Vulnerabilities resulting from these gaps can be addressed through passive immunization, which is a safe and effective intervention that rapidly confers adequate antibody levels. However, pervasive gaps in knowledge and competence concerning vaccination and the use of hyperimmune globulin for post-exposure prophylaxis have been documented. In the case of preventable infections, such as rabies and tetanus, morbidity and mortality continue to occur worldwide despite the availability of vaccines, hyperimmune globulins, and treatment guidelines. Evidence indicates that adherence to treatment recommendations is not universally optimal, resulting in 50,000 to 55,000 people who die needlessly of rabies each year. Cases of tetanus in the United States are rare, but occur primarily in people whose vaccinations are either incomplete or unknown and who are victims of trauma. Because of its clinical severity, significant treatment-related costs, and high associated mortality, tetanus continues to warrant considerable concern. With enhanced knowledge of timely and safe administration of vaccines and hyperimmune globulins for post-exposure prophylaxis, early identification of at-risk populations, and application of clinical guidelines and recommendations, prevention of rabies and tetanus may be attainable on a wider scale. This CME activity offers physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and other healthcare professionals the opportunity to close professional practice gaps in knowledge and competence with regard to vaccination and the use of hyperimmune globulin for post-exposure prophylaxis. This activity is supported by Griefholz. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Welcome to Medscape, Continuing Medical Education Spotlight, and to this program titled Protecting Vulnerable Patients and Post-Exposure Prophylaxis for Rabies and Tetanus, What, How, and When. I'm Dr. Kumar Alagappan, Professor of Clinical Emergency Medicine at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx, New York. On our panel, we have Dr. Kathy Morris, Assistant Professor at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha and Emergency Room Nurse Practitioner. Dr. John Marshall is a Clinical Pharmacy Coordinator in Critical Care at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Here are our learning objectives. On completion of this activity, the participant should be able to describe the role of active and passive immunization in the management of common exposures, such as wounds and animal bites. Identify patients with immune vulnerabilities in order to provide timely and effective post-exposure prophylaxis. Implement evidence-based practices concerning the management of exposure to rabies and tetanus. Participants are reminded to review the disclosures of the faculty and accreditation information for this activity on the accompanying page. Active versus passive immunization. Active immunization is when an antigen is introduced into the body and the body develops antibodies. Antigens are derived from viral or bacterial components, and if there are toxins, they can toxoids are produced as antigens. Now, passive immunization occurs when there's immune sera obtained from human donors, nonspecific IgIV, and there are also pathogen-specific immunoglobulins, such as for rabies, hepatitis B, and also tetanus. Active immunization, when you inject the antigen, it takes about 7 to 10 days for antibodies to develop. So there's a window of vulnerability after exposure. Active immunization also produces long-lasting memory. But this also may be, if one gives passive immunization, this may also inhibit the active immunization that's taking place. The advantages of passive immunization, you get immediate and temporary protection, and it's usually derived from human sera. The rationale for use of hyperimmune globulins in post-exposure prophylaxis is to give you passive immunization. We also want to identify populations that are at high risk when they get exposed to a particular disease, such as rabies and tetanus. And we want to provide protection during the window of vulnerability. Let's take a closer look at how and when hyperimmune globulins are used clinically by evaluating some potential exposures and appropriate responses. John has brought an interesting case for us to discuss.
Thank you. So the case today will be MJ, who is a 48-year-old man who is visiting relatives in New Mexico. He was hiking in the brush around dusk when he startled a fox. The fox pursued him, nipping at his feet. Before retreating, the fox bit and scratched MJ in the shin area. MJ's host suggested cleaning the wound with hydrogen peroxide and bandaging. But in addition, MJ decided to visit the emergency department at a local hospital.
Kathy, what are some of the key considerations at this point for this patient?
Well, there's several considerations for evaluation and treatment of animal bites. One consideration with certain animal bites should include rabies. And as you know, rabies is a potentially fatal viral infection. It's acquired from exposure to an infected animal, which may be wild or domestic, and it is rare but enzootic in the continental U.S. and in Puerto Rico. About 55,000 people, half of them children, die annually worldwide of rabies. Public health measures have dramatically reduced the incidence of human rabies. Vaccination of companion animals, of course, is very important, and wildlife. The education of healthcare professionals and veterinarians has really helped with that, and the institution of a rabies prophylaxis program. Now, between 1980 and 2009, there were 43 cases of human rabies in the U.S. 39 of those were associated with bat exposure. The median age was female patients were 14 years, and the median age for male patients was 46 years. The rabies virus is transmitted when skin or mucous membrane is contaminated with saliva or specific body fluids from an infected animal. And we need to realize that that would be saliva or neural tissues, not blood, urine, or feces. There's a 1 to 3 month incubation period. However, the disease acutely rapidly progresses into encephalomyelitis, and that could be followed by death in 20 days. I think we're all very familiar with hydrophobia as one of the main symptoms that is seen. However, also muscle spasms, paralysis, and altered mental status occur. The epizootology of rabies is usually occurs with wild animals, of course, raccoons, skunks, bats, foxes and mongooses. And if you look at the geographic distribution, you'll see that there are some areas that have specific problems with specific animals. However, it's not solely those animals. Perhaps you see a lot of skunks in the Midwest, raccoons on the East Coast. However, there are other animals, such as the bats, of course, that you do see nationwide. It's important to consult your local Department of Health to know exactly what's going on in your region. When we look at exposure assessment, we look at bite versus non-bites. And this is concerning with bats, because in bat cases, we don't necessarily see a bite occurring. A person who is an unattended child, someone sleeping, or an intoxicated person, or a mentally incapacitated person who's found in a room with a bat or handling a bat should be considered to be at risk. Bites can be provoked or non-provoked. And look at the type of animal. Of course, look at your local epizootology and laboratory testing of the animal if possible, which is not always possible. If an animal is of the type that transmits rabies and is unavailable of testing, of course, rabies prophylaxis should be administered. If you look at the post-exposure timing, you can see that rabies does have the highest case fatality of any infectious disease. However, it can be prevented if the prophylaxis is carried out in time. And this is very notable on the following graph, where you can see the humoral response occurs as early as 7 days.
Let's take a case. A nurse practitioner takes MJ's history and examines the wound. MJ has two small non-bleeding erythematous puncture wounds, about 5 millimeters in depth, and several superficial scratches on his left leg. Based on the unusual behavior of the fox, she calls the local Department of Health and learns that there are rabid foxes in her county, and foxes should be regarded as rabid unless proven negative by laboratory tests. She cleans the wound with iodine, povidone iodine, and takes an immunization history. MJ has not previously received rabies vaccine. He had a complete series of tetanus, and his last tetanus was 5 years ago. In this case, we have a man living in New Mexico who was bitten by a fox. What is the appropriate consideration for rabies? John?
Thank you. So in terms of rabies acute treatment, I think there's two important considerations here. The first of which is that this was a fox, and that in New Mexico, rabies is enzootic in foxes. The second and probably more important aspect of this case is that the fox is not available for testing, so that we do have to assume, for all intents and purposes, that the fox was rabid. We could debate on whether or not this was a provoked versus an unprovoked attack, but again, because this is an animal known to carry or harbor rabies and unavailable for testing, we need to assume the worst. It's also important, per Dr. Morris's point, that this is a medical urgency and not an emergency. Because this virus takes some time to develop in patients, if we don't have the rabies immune globulin in the hospital on that day, certainly getting it in a very timely fashion is important, but it's not something that we need to necessarily immediately jump on within the first few hours. If we get that patient the appropriate therapy within a few hours, if not days, it's appropriate. Wound care is also very important for these patients. Cleaning the wound with a virucidal agent, whether that's benzyl arconium chloride or povidone iodine, is certainly appropriate, as well as avoiding closure of the wound when appropriate for other infectious causes. CDC guidelines have recently been updated in 2008 to reflect an active vaccine to a 4-dose series as opposed to a 5-dose series. And this is based on rabies virus pathogenesis, animal studies, and clinical studies. If patients have not previously been vaccinated, they can receive one of two types of rabies vaccine. That's either a human diploid cell vaccine or a purified chick embryo cell vaccine. Both vaccines are IM, and they're comparable in efficacy and safety. And there have to date been no post-exposure prophylaxis failures reported in the U.S. Both are well tolerated, and usually the series is completed with the same vaccine that the series is started with. Both vaccines are 1 mL IM injection that's injected into the deltoid in adults and older children, and in the outer aspect of the thigh in younger children. And it's given one dose each on days 0, 3, 7, and 14. If the patient is immunosuppressed for whatever reason, you're going to want to administer the traditional 5-dose vaccine, adding a day 28 dose. In addition to the vaccine, we also want to give the patient rabies immune globulin. And optimally, this is started at day 0, but again, getting to that timing, it can be administered up to day 7 in patients who are at risk for rabies exposure. The dose is 20 units per kilo of body weight. And if possible, you want to administer the full dose in and around, infiltrated around the wound. If for whatever reason the wound is in an area where you cannot do that, whether it's in the hand or in the shin area, you're going to administer the rest of the volume at a site distant from the active vaccine. It's also important to note that because rabies immune globulin is developed from hyperimmunized human donors, there is a potential for infectious agents, a CJD variant or other unknown agents. The risk is low, but it is especially compared to the risk of the patient developing rabies. And there certainly has been no documented transmission of adventitious agents with the use of this agent. Tolerability is very good for this agent, and the most common is kind of a mild systemic reaction. Hypersensitivity can be rare. There is no need to test patients who complete post-exposure prophylaxis in this case. Those patients, it's important to know, who have been previously vaccinated, those would include veterinarians and animal care workers, do not need to get rabies immune globulin. They simply get 2 booster doses of vaccine at day 0 and 3.
Based on the risk of rabies, the ED physician must recommend MJ receive the recommended prophylaxis with 4 doses of rabies vaccine and 20 international units per kg of HRIG. In addition to our concern about rabies, there is a common issue related to animal bites and other puncture wounds, which is the prevention of tetanus. Tetanus is a disease that's caused by Clostridium tetani. It's a ubiquitous gram-positive anaerobic organism that's present everywhere. The spores are highly resistant to heat and chemicals, and it's very difficult to destroy. When tetanus is non-communicable, however, there is no herd immunity in populations. There's a very high case fatality ratio, and the infection does not confer immunity, and there is no herd immunity. So if someone develops tetanus, if they do happen to recover, they may not have potentially developed antibodies to tetanus. How does tetanus occur? The spore enters through an acute or chronic break in the skin, and it lives in the tissue, and in anaerobic conditions, it starts to vegetate and it produces a toxin called tetanospasmin. It's probably one of the most toxic neurotoxins known to man. What happens is this toxin is picked up by the peripheral nerve and it's carried retrograde intraaxonally to the spinal cord. And at the spinal cord, what it does is it inhibits the inhibitory afferent neurons, causing a tetany. And the only way to get cured is have this protein broken down, and this can be anywhere from 3 to 6 months. So it's supportive care. Tetanus is a spectrum of disease. It can be either localized, generalized. There's also cephalic tetanus, which is really localized tetanus that occurs in the head. And there's another form of tetanus called neonatal tetanus. Tetanus is a clinical diagnosis, and it's really a diagnosis of exclusion. There's no real test you can do in the emergency department to prove it's tetanus. Incubation for tetanus is often 3 to 20 days, and the shorter the incubation, the worse the outcome. Tetanus causes muscle spasms, rigidity, autonomic dysfunction, and people do not die from tetanus, they die from the complications of tetanus. How do you treat tetanus? Basically supportive. You have to give the patient fluids, you have to protect the airway, and there's no way to neutralize the toxin that's already bound to the inhibitory afferent neurons. However, the immunoglobulin can neutralize unbound toxin, which is why we give tetanus immunoglobulin to patients who may have developed tetanus. You treat the infection with metronidazole and you debride the wound. The metronidazole will go after the Clostridia tetani. And what you want to do is also control the rigidity and spasms. You sedate the patient and may have to give neuromuscular blockade. And these patients could be in the ICU for up to 6 months. And you have to control the autonomic dysfunction. Returning to our patient, how should clinicians approach a puncture wound or animal bite with regard to tetanus? Kathy?
The best way to prevent tetanus, of course, is with immunization. The incidence of tetanus has fallen dramatically since the 1950s, although the number of cases among the elderly does remain constant. Current recommendations are for the Tdap for primary and boosters to be given to children and adolescents as well as adults. Of course, for the infants and children, we use the Dtap, which includes the 5 childhood vaccines, and many of these are combination vaccines now, so the children don't have to get as many shots. And the pertussis component, if it's contraindicated, they can actually just receive the DT. And then in adults, we use the Tdap with adolescents and children 7 to 10 who are not fully immunized, and the TD in children greater than 7 years. The Tdap can be given regardless of the interval since the last tetanus diphtheria. Adolescents and adults who are younger than 65 who have not received the Tdap should be immunized as soon as feasible. And the Tdap for those who are greater than 65 years of age, which is close contact with infants or who want to be protected. Of course, with the wound management, the acute or the majority of tetanus-related wounds are acute. If they're tetanus-prone, we look at the age, the depth of the wound, what was the mechanism of injury, is there infection present, is that skin around that wound devitalized or contaminated? We see many very severe contaminated wounds in my area. Is it ischemic? Is the blood flow decreased to that area? Is there sensation gone? Has there been a nerve cut? Of course, it's important to recognize and treat serious injury initially. And then the management of infection risk is always important, including any antimicrobial. And the wound closure should be individualized. When considering chronic wounds, which is actually the minority of our concerns with the tetanus, we look at ulcers, at gangrene and abscesses, dental, intravenous drug users, and other identified injuries, and the need for debridement. You've studied the prophylaxis practices in the ED in great detail. What do you find about how tetanus risk is managed?
We had had a multi-center trial study at 5 university emergency departments in 1999 to 2000, and it was called Care of Wounds, and antitoxin level was drawn, and the immunization practices of ED physicians. There were many high-risk groups seen in the EDs in the 5 universities, and only 57% of the ED patients with wounds received appropriate prophylaxis. Patients with high-risk wounds were at the highest risk of mismanagement. And what's interesting is of the 2,500 patients that were seen in these 5 university EDs, only 2 were given TIG. And one of those that received TIG was given incorrectly. So with our patient, how would you assess to determine the best appropriate approach to immunization? Dr. Marshall?
Thank you. So it's pretty clear that there are certain patients who are at greater risk for developing tetanus in the U.S. than others, and certainly at the top of that list are elderly patients. Data has shown that about 60% of tetanus cases in the U.S. are in patients greater than the age of 60, and this may be due to a age-related immune suppression or the fact that these patients may not be getting their booster doses. Also, patients who are at risk for tetanus include those born outside of the U.S. It's been seen that Mexican Americans have about a 60% immunity rate to tetanus, and Korean Americans have only about a 20% immunity rate to tetanus. As mentioned before, diabetes is certainly an infection or a risk factor for tetanus, as intravenous drug use or patients with immunosuppressive conditions. This graph really summarizes well what we should be doing for patients who have at-risk tetanus wounds. And you can see that it's broken into patients who've had either an uncertain vaccination history or they have received their primary history. So walking across the table here, you'll see that patients who have had an uncertain vaccination history who have a clean minor wound should be getting Tdap and their primary tetanus series. If it's a clean or minor wound, tetanus immune globulin should not be given. If that patient, though, has a high-risk wound, they need to, in addition to be getting the Tdap or tetanus, also be getting the tetanus immune globulin. In situations where patients have had three or more of the primary series for tetanus and they have a clean or minor wound, you're going to give them that follow-up dose, as Dr. Morris had mentioned. And if they do have a more severe wound, again, tetanus immune globulin is not indicated, but again, certainly making sure that they're up to date on their boosters. One important aspect I'd like to note from the pharmacy perspective is that there's been a lot of confusion between the Tdap and the DTaP mm-hmm. vaccine. So using the brand names, whether it's Boostrix or Adacel, to make sure that we're giving the Tdap vaccine to those who should get it and reserving that DTaP vaccine for children, I think is a really important note, even today. I think the other important note is any adult who is age 19 to 64 who requires tetanus either for an exposure or for their next booster dose should be getting Tdap if they haven't previously received it.
Just one more point here, which is it says patients who are over the age of 65, it wasn't actually studied. The Tdap was not studied initially, which is why it's not in the original recommendations to give it to people over the age of 65. And Tdap can be given one day after the last DT, because pertussis has become a major problem now
right.
in the adult population. The other thing is, reason why elderly patients, many of them do not have tetanus antibodies, this country, the United States, we started immunizing children from the 1950s on. And if you have a primary immunization series, you really don't have to give TIG anymore. So it was after World War II we started immunizing people. So the elderly are still at risk for developing tetanus.
So in terms of the tetanus immune globulin, there is separate dosing for prophylaxis and for treatment. The prophylaxis dose is 250 international units intramuscular, whereas the treatment dose is 3,000 to 6,000 units. Again, as with rabies immune globulin, when you administer this, you want to make sure you give it in a different syringe and at a different site from the tetanus toxoid or the Tdap that you're giving to prevent neutralization. And administer the rest of that IM dose distant to the active vaccine site administration. The other important point with these immune globulins, not just with tetanus immune globulin, but you want to make sure you space these out from other live vaccines because these immune globulins can attenuate the patient's vaccine response to other live vaccines, and MMR is a good example of that. The safety of tetanus immune globulin is analogous to that of rabies immune globulin. Again, as with any other product developed from human sources, there are potential for infectious agents, again, CJD variant or unknown agents. The risk is low, especially considering the risk of developing tetanus, and there to date has been no documented transmission of adventitious agents to patients. Tolerability is usually very good with these agents. Erythema pain can be present at the injection site. There can be some soreness, and mild temperature elevation can occur.
So in summary, when assessing a risk for rabies from a wildlife contact, it is helpful to know the prevalence of rabies in the local area for the particular animal of the particular animal species. Potential rabies exposures are a medical urgency, and when appropriate, post-exposure prophylaxis should be consist of a four-dose vaccine series and human rabies immune globulin. When persons from vulnerable populations, such as the elderly, diabetics, immigrants, IVDUs, or immunocompromised patients present to the ED with high-risk wounds, consideration should be given about their tetanus immunization history. You have to recognize that tetanus can occur even in the absence of a tetanus-prone wound. Over half the people who develop tetanus don't know how they got it. Tetanus can occur 6 months after an injury. So when administering tetanus, you want to make sure you give the passive, which is the TIG, separate from the active immunization, which is the DT or the Tdap, or there are several different tetanus toxoids one can give, but you want to give the immunizations at different sites. That concludes our program today, and I'd like to thank my colleagues, Dr. Kathy Morris and Dr. John Marshall. I hope that you found the information in today's discussion informative and useful for your practice. Please take a moment to complete the post-test and evaluation so that you can receive the CME credit. Thank you for participating in this Medscape CME Spotlight, protecting vulnerable patients with post-exposure prophylaxis for rabies and tetanus. What, how, and when?
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Protecting Vulnerable Patients with post-exposure prophylaxis for rabies and tetanus, what, how, and when. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.